Okay, so I'm going to talk about primordial gravity waves, the other kind of gravity waves, ones that are a little bit less immediate excitement, but still very interesting nonetheless. And in particular, a signature of primordial gravity waves and a way of searching for gravity waves using the large scale structure of the universe. So the reason that primordial gravity waves are a big deal, I'm sure I don't have to tell this to this audience, but it's just that they're a direct window into the early universe, right? So if there's some primordial gravity wave background, then that was probably was created somewhere near the Big Bang singularity time or in a period of inflation there shortly after or in some early universe process. And they propagate basically unimpeded through the universe. And so any observations we can make of that is a window into the direct physics of the very early universe. And the normal way that we look, as cosmologists, we look for primordial gravity waves is in the cosmic microwave background. So in the polarization of the cosmic microwave background, you can decompose that the polarization into two fields, the E mode field and the B mode polarization. This is the parity even polarization pattern and the parity odd polarization pattern. And the unique thing that makes B mode polarization, the unique primordial thing that makes B mode polarization is primordial gravity waves. There's also contamination from lensing at highish L, but that's a second order effect. But it is still a big foreground for these gravity waves, for these B modes. But that's how many groups are currently trying to look for primordial gravity waves. I want to answer the question, is there a signature for this instead of using the CMB, is there a signature for primordial gravity waves in the large scale structure of the universe? If we had big 3D maps of the density of the universe on very large scales, could we use those maps to search for the gravity wave background? And so that's what this talk is about. What is that signature? How would you look for it? And how sensitive would it be? So the first people to start thinking along these lines, or maybe not the very first, but certainly one of the sort of the seminal works, was this paper by Scott Donaldson, Eduardo Rosso, and Albert Sebbins, where they thought about the galaxy lensing from the gravity wave background, in particular the B-mode lensing from the gravity wave background, because normal scalar perturbations, density perturbations that cause weak lensing, that normally only contributes to the E-mode, the same parity even pattern of the shear, but you get this parity odd swirly shear from gravity waves. And so they calculated this, and they found that the naive calculation gave a signal sort of in the CL space that looks like this dashed line. For comparison, it peaks at very low L, very large scales, sort of L of 2 and 3 is where all the signal is, so the quadrupole and the octupole. And then the noise for an LSST-like survey says, you could get a few sigma detection of that in something like LSST for what was the upper limits on gravity waves at the time, which I think was something around 0.1. And they that's what this line is for, I think, is the tensor scalar ratio of 0.1. So that's kind of marginally okay, right? A few sigma detection if you've no systematics on really large scale, where systematics are really hard for galaxy lensing. And all the signal comes from, because it's on large scales, it's telling you that all the signal comes from gravity waves that are entering the horizon now, right? They're super horizon. They were super horizon until the modern universe, and they're just entering the horizon right now. They're becoming dynamical. And they're causing the signal. But it turns out that 90% of the signal is actually a coordinate artifact, though. So the real signal is actually down here, which is really hard to detect, an order of magnitude lower. And the They figured this out just by carefully looking at what the assumptions are, where the signal came from. It turns out the major contribution to the signal was the shear from the gravity waves right at the galaxies, right? So if they looked at where that signal was coming from, it was just the fact that the galaxies themselves were sheared by the gravity waves. But back at high redshift, back where the galaxies are, that gravity wave hasn't actually entered the horizon yet. It hasn't actually become dynamical. It's still super horizon and frozen. And therefore, these galaxies formed in the early universe. They virialized the round on sub-horizon scales. They can't know anything about this super horizon gravity wave, right? The super horizon gravity wave, just from the equivalence principle, the local dynamics can't know about it until it becomes dynamical. And therefore, they just made the wrong assumption, right? They assumed the galaxies were sheared by the metric shear in the gravity waves, but they can't be. And so if you make the opposite assumption that the galaxies are always round in their local inertial frames, then you get rid of 90% of the signal, okay? And so that's disappointing. So in an LSST-like survey, you can't really use galaxy shear, galaxy lensing to look for the gravity wave background. And then if you ask, okay, well, what about gravity waves that are in the that have already entered the horizon, right? So at higher redshift, it'll be a different scale of gravity waves that entered the horizon. But the wavelength, so the period, the oscillation period of those gravity waves is still very long compared to like the dynamical time scale of galaxies. So you kind of expect galaxies just to stay round in their local inertial frame always, right? You don't actually expect galaxies to oscillate with the gravity waves, right? I mean, it's the same way that like my laser pointer isn't oscillating with LIGO gravity waves, right? It has forces that are happening, that are keeping it the same shape in its local inertial frame. The LIGO mirrors are test masses, so they oscillate, but galaxies aren't. They're moving, they're dynamical objects, right? That should virialize and be round. Not individually round, but statistically round, of course. But then there's something that doesn't virialize, and that's the large-scale structure of the universe, right? There's another type of lensing shear, so instead of talking about galaxy lensing shear, something that's also been detected is CMB shear, right? So that's not stretches of statistically round objects. Those are stretches of the cosmic microwave background, which is just a Gaussian random field that has no intrinsic directions in it, right? And then when you put a lensing shear in front of it, then you get local patches of sort of preferred directions. And you can look for that in lensing shear surveys. And that's been detected by Planck and ACT and SCT. And so you can sort of think about doing the same thing for a large-scale structure, right? So if you have a large-scale structure field, so this is just a toy simulation of what large-scale structure might look like. It's a log-normal Gaussian random field with a certain power spectrum. And this large-scale structure has no preferred directions. I can't look at this and say, oh, there's a direction on the sky and any local patch that's preferred over another direction. But in the presence of tensor modes, gravity waves, you might end up with something like this, right? Where you clearly have local patches where all the structures are aligned this way, and over here they're aligned this way, and over here they're aligned this way again. So on a patch-by-patch directions, you put in preferred directions, and you break statistical isotropy in local patches, and you can use that property that without the shear, that the structure should be isotropic, and map out where the shear is, right? So I can make a map here saying, oh, I can try to measure the shear this way and this way and this way and say, oh, I've got, I can measure the spatial dependence of this shear.
But this is just lensing effect, or?
Lensing does this, but I'm going to try to convince you that that gravity waves also do this.
Okay. And you've got to convince us you can distinguish those two.
Talk to me a little bit later about distinction. I'm going to talk about the statistical sensitivity, but yes, you can distinguish them. Because
you're not going to try to convince us.
I didn't put those slides in this particular talk, as I wanted to talk more about the physics of it and more than the analysis. But basically, just because it's the gravity waves are a 3D field, then they'll be tensor-like, and that's distinguishable from a vector field, right? Lensing is always a vector field, not a tensor field.
Good.
So the large scale structure should be evolving with the tensor mode shear, right? The gravity waves are there. They're not virial objects, right? And so that this type of shear should be oscillating in our maps of large scale structure. If only we could have the sensitivity to see it. And so that should be a detectable thing. If you look at what gravity waves do, how they evolve over time, this is the tensor transfer function. So at early times, when tensor modes are gravity waves, I'll use those words interchangeably, basically, when they're super horizon, they're frozen, right? That whatever their initial amplitude was that was generated, that just stays. And then once the wavelength becomes comparable to the universe scale, the horizon scale, then they start to evolve, and they oscillate for a bit, but they also decay from redshifting. Okay? So this is telling us that that maybe our large scale structure, it should be sheared at early times from this large wavelength gravity wave, and that should that shear should decay and oscillate for a bit, and be unsheared today, right? For in a universe that has, say, just one gravity wave mode and a whole field of large scale structure. But actually, you could have made a different assumption about the initial conditions, right? So you could just, to make this maximally unreadable, I just flipped over the plot. but so this is just the same plot, but upside down. You could have assumed that the large scale structure, it has the exact intrinsic shear that cancels the tensor mode shear initially, right? And then as the tensor mode enters the horizon and starts to oscillate, that cancellation becomes unperfect, and then you end up at late times with a shear that's permanent. Okay? And you don't actually a priori know which of these two situations should be right unless you think very carefully about the initial conditions of the universe. Okay? In particular, you need to think about the initial conditions in the order at which these modes were generated at early times. So I actually had a whole slide that was just that sentence. Yes, I have to think about the initial conditions. So I'm going to assume inflation for those initial conditions and see what comes out. Okay, I know that's taboo here, but I mean just for give me a well-defined model where I can just do it and it's easy. I'm going to use inflation.
No excuses necessary. That's perfectly fine.
All right. Okay. So I'm going to begin at some early time in inflation, where we've generated a tensor mode that's sort of the horizon scale. The wavelength is of the horizon scale. Okay. And inflation, it generates the large scale modes before it generates the small scale modes. Okay. So I'm going to let the universe evolve, and inflation makes the universe expand a whole bunch and zooms us in. And it stretches that mode until it's spatially constant on a horizon scale. Okay. Now, if the tensor mode is spatially constant on the horizon scale, that means I should be able to gauge it away, right? I should be able to do a coordinate transform that everywhere in my Hubble patch, I don't care about that gravity wave. And so the right coordinate transformation is just a stretch of the coordinates. So I apply that stretch of the coordinates, and I get rid of the shear. But now I have an anisotropic coordinate grid where my y-coordinate, I've just stretched it a bit just to get rid of the shear. So this grid is the original coordinates, whereas the actual sizes on the screen are my new coordinates. So this is like the local inertial frame or the frame in which the expansion is locally isotropic. Okay, and my claim is that if this is the frame in which I should think about the generation of scalar perturbations, right? It's the frame where the expansion of the universe is isotropic. So the metric is just locally Robertson-Walker, and I'm going to generate a scalar mode. So this is my scalar mode. I'm just going to mod in this cartoon. It's just a circle or a sphere. Okay, I put it in, and that's that's what it should look like. But notice that the coordinates are sheared compared to this scalar mode. Okay, And then at late times, the tensor mode evolves. So then inflation ends. This thing stays round because that tensor mode's always superhorizon. But then eventually, at very late times, this thing's very subhorizon. And then the tensor mode itself also becomes subhorizon. And it starts to oscillate and decay. And once that process of oscillation and decay is over, then I'm left with this. And my scalar mode is anisotropic in the final state. Okay. So just to show that I didn't do that whole thing using only cartoons. This is the metric you would write down at first, right? This is the coordinate transformation you do that makes with new coordinates that are locally isotropic at a point. So that's the new metric, which is indeed just Robertson Walker plus something that's zero at the origin because it's proportional to these new coordinates. Okay. But it's only zero at one point. And if I go away from that point, then that's not true anymore. So that's valid in sort of a Hubble-sized patch, okay? So that's like just like going to the local inertial frame of, that's just using equivalence principle. You're going to the local inertial frame of that the scalar perturbations. This is the coordinate in which my power spectrum, my scalar perturbation should have been isotropic. So here's my p tittle in these tilde coordinates, which is isotropic. But then in my final coordinates, in my other coordinates, the power spectrum is anisotropic, and the anisotropy just looks like this. It has two k's contracted with h in it. Okay. But then during inflation, this is the observable quantity. And then when the gravity wave is still superhorizon, this is the observable quantity. But after that gravity wave goes away, then my power spectrum will look like this in this local patch, right? This is a patch over which h has to be constant. Okay.
Is your gauge condition such that h dot k is zero?
This is the k of the scalar modes, not the k of the tensor modes. So for the tensor modes, I'll usually use like a capital K. I should definitely have said that. So the scalar modes have wave numbers that can be arbitrarily aligned with the h. So this k is many orders of magnitude bigger than the k of the gravity wave. The gravity wave is much larger scale than the scalar modes that are observable. So that's all of coordinates. So all I needed there was just the equivalence principle and coordinate transformations. You can derive that. So it turns out that there's a second term that hand wavy cartoon doesn't quite explain. And what that is that when this happens, when the tensor mode enters the horizon, the scalar mode is already well subhorizon, right? And it's growing. It's evolving. And when the tensor mode enters the horizon, it sees an anisotropic expansion of the universe. Okay, so the expansion of the universe becomes anisotropic just for a short period of time while that tensor mode is decaying. And therefore, it gets its growth function becomes anisotropic. Okay. Let's see. I wanted to do this slide first. So that just throws in a second term here with this alpha of cap. This depends on capital K now, the tensor mode wave number. And this one is just an integral of the, that depends on the cosmology and the evolution of the tensor.
So the order of this correction is like 10 to the minus 5 on top of
Yeah, so if h is like 10 to the minus 7-ish, right, the shear, then yeah, it's a 10 to minus 7 local anisotropy in the power spectrum. So yes, very small. But yeah, I'm going to talk about the detectability in a bit. Yeah.
Your assumption is inflation. What happens if you don't get the stretch?
So this term, this first term depends on how you generate your initial conditions. So if you in any theory where you can very carefully think about your initial conditions, then you should be able to figure out whether this term is there or not, or bigger or smaller. This term just depends on the late time expansion. And so this should exist no matter what theory you're using, as long as you assume that, as long as you assume Big Bang cosmology, that long wavelength modes enter the horizon after short wavelength modes, which is just obviously true, right? It's an observational fact. And so this term is cosmology independent, I think, and this term is early universe theory independent. This one is early universe dependent. Depends on how you generate your initial conditions. And you could probably, I don't think you can make a theory where they cancel, but you might be able to.
Second term might be perhaps.
What's that?
Second term might be perhaps. Log P to log K. Depends on the initial condition.
It depends on the early universe theory. So you need to think very carefully about the initial condition, which is all we've done. We've just done that for inflation.
So if you only have 2 alpha, K, what's the possibility of detecting?
So this is about, at very small scales, this is roughly a constant, and it's like -2.5 in the late universe. And this turns out to be 0.4. For the most easily observable modes. So this is like 2/3 of the signal, and that's 1/3 of the signal. They're almost exact same order of magnitude. It doesn't really affect it, surprisingly. But we can go into that in a little bit more detail in a bit. So this is a full expression, including both this coordinate transformation term and this tide term, this term that's from the anisotropic expansion. So the really nice thing about this is that this is a permanent signature of a decayed gravity wave in the late time structure. So it's a fossil, okay? So you have the way we thought about the initial conditions is you have an early during inflation you generate the gravity wave on large scales. Then the horizon shrinks. You generate the scalar modes. Horizon continues to shrink in conformal coordinate and co-moving coordinates. But then at late times, when the horizon is big and the gravity waves enter the horizon, it decays away. But after that decay, that's when I have the observable signature, right? There's this fossil record of what the tensor mode was that's permanent.
But the fossil is created in the Big Bang era.
What's that?
The fossil is created in the Big Bang.
Yeah, but it's not observable in the Big Bang era because as long as that tensor mode is super horizon, I can gauge it away. I shouldn't have any observational signatures of it, right? So it doesn't become observable until it re-enters the horizon and leaves its anisotropic imprint. So far I've talked about a small patch where H of the universe, where H is constant, where there's no spatial dependence to H, where you get this. Globally, what you get when you consider that H also has a wave number, you get mode coupling, right? And so the normal two-point function is normally has the power spectrum and the direct delta here, so there's no coupling between modes. And then you have this other part where you couple. Where you couple K and K prime based on the difference between the wave numbers, right? So this difference is small, so that's the long wavelength low K tensor mode. So I have a way, from this two-point function, I have a way of estimating the full H, the full H Fourier fields. So that gives me an estimator. So I can derive from this an estimator for HAB. But then, of course, if I want the tensor power spectrum, then I need two powers of H. So the total estimator is going to be a four-point function on my scalar perturbations, in very much the same way that weak lensing, CMB weak lensing estimators, to get the weak lensing power spectrum, you need to do a four-point function on, say, the temperature. So now I'll talk a bit about the detectability, and I'll revisit it in a bit. So this is so if you go through the forecast and figure out how detectable this is, you get these bottom. So look at the dashed lines, not the solid lines. So you get the you look at the solid lines, not the dashed lines. You get the solid lines. And so you need just a lot of modes to see this, right? So there's a 10 to the minus 7 shear for the current upper limit on R. It's like a 10 to the minus shear on the power spectrum. And so you need to go out to a wave number of something like 10 and a 200 gigaparsec cube volume in order to be competitive with current CMB constraints. This is a little bit outdated.
What's scalar vector tensor?
So this paper was a generalization of this idea to both vectors and scalars as well. Although they did a very general thing where they didn't consider a specific theory. So actually, there's twice as much signal for the tensors as they imagined there would be in this paper. So these lines are a little bit lower, but not much. That's hard, right? K of 10, 200 cubic gigaparsecs is really hard. What makes this even remotely interesting is the prospect of the 21 centimeter long, right? There's this line, this radial line in neutral hydrogen, the hyperfine slitting between the aligned electron and proton spins, the anti-aligned electron and proton spins, that has a wavelength of 21 centimeters. It's a hyperfine splitting. So this line's long being used sort of locally and in the near universe to map out, to study galaxies and the distribution of neutral gas. But there's this budding field to map the large-scale structure of the universe using this line. And the thing that's really exciting about it is that it gives you access to just a lot of the universe. Right? So this teal region is the whole volume of the universe that's in principle accessible using the 21 centimeter line, where the red region is the volume of the universe we've mapped to date using galaxy surveys. This is actually out of date. So this red region is quite a bit bigger now with BOSS, but not dramatically so. And so there's just a lot of information in the universe that we haven't tapped. And the 21 centimeter line, that these hydrogen surveys are a way of doing it. So the total amount of volume is like 1,000 cubic gigaparsecs. You go to a really high redshift, the universe is optically thin to this line at all redshifts, so you can go all the way to redshift 50. It is in principle observable, although you need a very sensitive telescope to do it. At redshift 50, the maximum scale at which that's linear is like k of 1,000. And so there's like 10 to the 18 modes in the universe that you could go after to try to learn about the universe. And so if you look at this graph now in that context, you see, well, if I go to k of 100 and stay at this 200 gigaparsecs, so I'm still only going after a small fraction of the total information of the universe, this line scales as k to the minus 3, right? Because because I'm measuring a four-point function, right? So it scales very, very favorably with k max, twice as fast as you would
imagine. Right. How many modes fit on a computer?
Yeah, no. Well, not 10 to the 18. That's definitely true.
It's a number, I guess, we should know, right?
That depends if you need to do an n squared operation or an n cubed operation or not, right?
It depends on hard drive.
So 10 to the 18 is like, if you need one byte for each, is an exabyte, right? Which is like the storage capacity of the world. No, it's quite a bit less, right? Kendrick, you have something like the storage capacity of the world for at one byte per number. But
10 to the 18 modes now on a computer.
Sure. No, you can't even fit 10 to the 18 modes on a computer right now. You can't fit the map on all the hard drives in the world.
All the hard drives can do it. Okay, so that's good.
but even if Kmax of like 100, then the minimum R that you're sensitive to is like 10 to the minus 4, right? Because this scales so rapidly with Kmax. But now I'm going to convince you that the real benefit here is qualitative, not necessarily just quantitative. Okay, and that qualitative difference is the dimensionality the difference in dimensionality between the CMB and the large scale structure. So I can make a quadratic quantity on the scalar modes that's just a direct estimator for the 3D tensor field. Okay. Because I'm able to do that, I get a 3D map of the tensors instead of the CMB, which is sort of a projection of the tensors. So to show you why that's useful, I'm going to go into a diversion of something you can't do with the CMB, and then show you that you can do it with this sort. So this is my interlude on helicity in the CMB. So the question is, if the primordial background looked like this instead of this, could you tell the difference? Right. So this is a visualization of the tensor mode, of the tensor field, where the orientation of the ribbon is the orientation of the shear. Okay, and this is and the shear is all in the plane perpendicular to the ribbon, and the wave number is in this direction. And this is the normal thing, and this is just fully circularly polarized. Okay? And both of these would be, if they're generated in the early universe, would probably be standing waves. So these look very qualitatively very different, right? This fully circularly polarized field compared to the unpolarized field. And the question is, can you just tell the difference between these? Just to motivate that, we know from particle physics that nature is parity violating, right? So there's So you could have processes in the early universe that are parity violating and that could generate helical tensor fields. It turns out that this is one way to get baryogenesis through nonlinear couplings in the standard model. You can generate baryogenesis by coupling to one-handedness of neutrino and not the other, and then at high temperature converting that lepton number into baryon number. So basically, since the very first papers on EMB mode polarization, it was proposed that the CMB should also be sensitive to parity violation, to helicity. And that's because you have the B mode so tensor modes degenerate both E mode polarization and E mode polarization. The quadratic products of either of them are parity, have even parity, but the cross correlation between them has odd parity, and so it's only generated if there's parity violation in the tensor field. So the naive expectation, so if I just parameterize the total amount of helicity by just seeing the difference between the right-handed power spectrum and the left-handed power spectrum in units of the total power, the naive expectation is that the cross-correlation between the correlation coefficient, between E and B, so the EB correlation is a function of the geometric mean of EE and BB, that correlation coefficient should just be something like the helicity fraction, right? That if you just sort of wave your hands and guess what you expect, this is the number you'd guess. And then if you calculate what you actually get, that is true for TB. So TB is also parity violating, and the TB line falls right between BB and TT, especially at small scales. Not so much at large scales, but if you include reionization, which this plot doesn't, then it goes right in between. EE is about the same order of magnitude as BB from tensors. And EB is two orders of magnitude smaller. Right? And so even for maximal helicity, so that correlation coefficient is 0.01 even for maximal helicity. It's nothing, you just have this two orders of magnitude suppression. And what's the reason for that? So what's happening here? So the reason that parity violation is hard to see, helicity is hard to see in CMB, is just dimensionality, right? So there's a symmetry that prevents this, an approximate symmetry that prevents this from happening. So the way that polarization is generated is you have to have a quadrupole in the radiation. So you have the blue light coming from two sides and red light coming from the other side at the last scattering surface in the CMB. And that sends polarized light out this way. But it also sends the same amount of polarized light backwards away from you at the last scattering surface. And so there's this the polarization field has a reflection symmetry about the last scattering surface. An equivalent observer to us at the other side of the last scattering surface would see the same polarization field as we do, except mirror imaged, right? And so that cancels. That means If they live in the same universe, they should see the same EB correlations, and therefore it has to be zero. The only reason it's not exactly zero is because that reflectional symmetry is proximate. It's is because the last scattering surface is curved. It's not flat, right? And so it's entirely a curved sky effect that EB is non-zero at all. So, and then the other challenge that exasperates this is that the noise and EB gets sourced from has to come from both the EE correlations and the BB correlations, right? And even in the absence of gravity waves.
Sorry, yep. I mean, that doesn't make too much sense because that means that at larger Ls, this fraction should become a smaller, the EB to BB, but then. Since that, if you say it's just a Kerr-Viscoe effect, but since the fraction is constant.
Yeah, so it turns out that it's entirely from curved sky, and the effect doesn't have a 1 over L suppression. As strange as it is, it's just entirely the way, the entire effect comes from the first couple, there's an integral of two overlapping Bessel functions you have to do, and the entire effect comes from the first couple oscillations of those Bessel functions. And is basically constant as a function of L. And surprisingly,
saying there is no flattest sky analog of this EB correlation.
There is.
What you're saying? Or not?
No, I'm saying in flat sky you can calculate it and it's exactly zero.
But that's yeah. So you're saying it's exact. So that's the same. Okay. That's a
surprise. Yeah. No, it was really surprising, and the fact that this. So that really messed me up for a long time is when I calculated in flat sky and it was exactly zero. And I looked at this curve and it was parallel to this curve. And I just couldn't figure it out. And I just had to stare at the integration kernels for days before I figured out that it's just that you just have this weird, it's still a 1% effect, right? So it's very, very low. Right, and so you get, so the EB gets noise contributions from both BB and EE. But EE has, of course, a contribution from scalar perturbations, right? And so there's this irreducible noise that no matter how small the gravity waves are, that there you have a self noise from the CMB that you can't get rid of from scalar perturbations. And so the end result is that gravity wave helicity is basically unobservable in the CMB unless the helicity itself is very high fraction. And we're within a factor of few of the current upper limits on R. So both of these have to be true. For us to be able to observe the helicity. And that's entirely because of the dimensionality of the CMB. But back to these fossils, to this tidal effect, it preserves all geometric information, right? I get to make a 3D map, a truly 3D map of this thing. It'll be a noisy map, but it is fully 3D, has all the information. And so you can just show that the uncertainty on R is just equal to the uncertainty on chi, on the helicity fraction times R. And so it's equally easy to detect helicity as it is to detect the gravity waves themselves. And then so if you can just read off from this table what, because these two things are equal, you can read off from this table what's feasible, from this graph what's feasible, and scale it off the end of this graph, as I like to do for futuristic surveys. So if you get to k of if you get to k of 10, then at the current upper limits on R, then you can detect maximal helicity, which is already better than the CMB. But then I have another two orders of magnitude I can go, and maximum wave number if I really thought I could get all the information in the universe, and that means you can get you could get fractional helicities down to definitely sub percent levels, and you could even see order unity helicity if R is 10 to the minus 4 level, right? So you're much less limited in the type of microphysics you can do. Or the detailed physics of the gravity waves you can probe. That's all I wanted to say. So just to summarize, there's this tidal interaction that leaves just a permanent fossil of the gravity wave shear, of gravity waves in the large-scale structure shear. And then high redshift 21 Samir hydrogen surveys, they could be very extremely sensitive to the, in principle, extremely sensitive to the gravity wave background through this effect. just because there's so many modes, so much information out there. And that gives you, you know, just a fully 3D probe of those gravity waves. So you're much more sensitive to the detailed physics of the gravity waves than you would be through a 2D probe like the CD. Thank you very much.
Questions for Q? So if I understand correctly, you're working off of a tensor-scalar-scalar three-point function to generate the effect in, from the beginning, and the tensor is the long wavelength, and the scalar-scalar are the short wavelength, so it's the squeeze-type limit of a tensor-scalar-scalar three-point function.
That's exactly right, yeah.
That's right?
Yeah.
And so... So then is there an understanding of different shapes? Like, is it only the squeeze limit that can generate these kind of fossils? Or
you can't use the same arguments. Like, so I basically, the way I've always, that this derivation is done, is that you have to be able to gauge away the tensor mode and then work in this local inertial frame. And if you can't do that, then you just have to do a more detailed calculation. That has been done in much more generality than I've done it by Giddings and Soth. But it's not clear how you the physical picture is much less clear. But it's also not clear how you evolve that going forward and to final observables, right? Where here it's just very clear what the final observables are because the only thing you need is the equivalence principle. After that, you're just done. And so outside that squeeze limit, it's a much harder calculation. There has been a fairly detailed work on these tides done. A few things by Schmidt, Paget, and Zaldarriaga. But again, they're mostly working in the squeeze limit. So
maybe you mentioned this before I got here. So there would be a tidal field just due to the gravitational potential that kind of deforms everything. And is that the thing I could be confused with your effect? Just the standard tidal field.
The standard tidal field?
Yeah.
It's scalar-like, right?
But it would be, the second derivative of the potential at the IDJ.
Yeah, exactly, right. So if I use this estimator, make the map, then its trace of this estimator will get a big contribution from tidal effects.
Right.
So that's like a 10% effect. It's huge, right? But you have to use the geometric. This goes back to your initial question of how do I distinguish that from. And lensing from this, and you just have to use the geometric information that's in this this estimator, right? You can separate it into its vector E modes, vector B modes, E modes, you know, the trace part, and then the part that's transverse and traceless that you can't attribute to anything else.
The LIGO experiment, delta L over L, is the crucial. It's called the string.
Yeah, which is just H, right?
Delta L is 10 to the minus 16 centimeters. L is 4 kilometers, you've got 10 to the minus 21.
Mm-hmm.
How does that compare with this?
This is 10 to the minus... This, at current upper limits, is something like 10 to the minus 7 from inflation, it's 10 to the minus 7. But, you know, this is also on... The wavelength of that is gigaparsecs, right? You can't do it with an interferometer unless you have a billion years to do it.
LIGO is ordered.
What's that?
LIGO frequency is ordered.
Yeah, exactly. Now, people talk about doing BBO, right? Which you go to, I don't know the time scales there are probably seconds to minutes maybe for BBO. And that's a direct detection experiment, but then you're looking for the ones that have already decayed by many orders of magnitude due to the Hubble redshift thing, right? That started out at 10 to the minus 7 when they entered the horizon at redshift, you know, 10,000, no, many million.
Very much.
Yeah. But now they're gone. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I was wondering how linear the small scale mode has to be for this calculation to apply if it's very nonlinear and
variable. Yeah, yeah. So as soon as it variabilized, I think you're toast, right? I think complicated mode couplings that you get in the quasi-linear regime, I think those mode couplings will have shapes that aren't transverse traceless, but we haven't really discussed that. So that's why we're really thinking about high redshift 50 stuff where you know K-max is sort of genes length limited, not non-linearity limited.
So actually, on that note, have you thought about doing simulations with kind of anisotropic initial conditions, or is it something?
I've certainly thought about it many times, and then decided I never had time to get into such an intense research program for something quite so futuristic.
Okay, maybe future generation.
Yeah, I mean, so you can't make a simulation big enough to detect a 10 to the minus 7 shear, right? So you immediately have to put in the shear in at like the 10% level in order to, or 1%.
The goal is a slightly different simulation because, I mean, you know what you're putting in. So the thing is, you just want to see how much of a difference it makes in, I guess, in the power spectrum. So,
right. And in the quasi-linear regime, for sure. I've thought about it.
You could put it to much bigger amplitudes because, I mean, really just the idea is to just calibrate it.
Exactly. Yeah, and I agree, and I've thought about it many times, seriously several times, and then decided I had other things I had to do.
10 minutes.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, and I have short talk.
Sorry. What are the constraints on the primordial tensor scalar Gaussian energy? You can make your signal bigger. This is the minimal case, right?
This is the minimal case, right? So primordial calculations calculated the exact same thing that we did, but was just never clear that was actually an observable. So I don't know. I mean, there have been works that have done it in more complicated multi-field inflation models, and I'm haven't. Yeah, I don't know. Don't know the absolute details of how all that works. When you do those primordial calculations, it's always hard for me, at least, to know whether or not the final spectrum you get out, the bispectrum you get out, or trispectrum, is observable or entirely a coordinate artifact. There's this big debate coming out of Matthias's group that the minimal non-Gaussianity you get is completely unobservable, which I've had trouble deciding which side of that debate I'm on. So. What's that?
Lisa.
Yeah. So Lisa at low frequencies gets confusion from the neutron star background, right? Just the wide separation neutron stars, they eventually drown out your Big Bang signal. But if you go to BBO, which is three Lisas, then you resolve out and deconfuse all the. Oh, actually, Lathan knows exactly this, right? This is like what you worked on for years.
White dwarf.
So you get you have this confused signal, and so you have to resolve out all those white dwarfs. And once you do that and deconfuse them, then you can go after Big Bang inflationary gravitations.
Question about, so if I understand correctly, you were talking about seeing the signal, so basically after the primordial gravitational waves decay away, the question is there a residual intrinsic shear of the large scale structure in our local frame of reference today? And then there's another effect, which is that gravitational waves could lens the light as it travels from the large scale structure to us, and so we would see it effectively. We would see it would be apparently sheared.
Yeah. So the motivating paper for that was Scott, for our work was Scott Donaldson and Albert Sebbins and Eduardo Rosso's work on just lensing. on just galaxy ellipticity lensing. But that turns out just to be way smaller, right? So the fossil gives you is a huge advantage because it's every mode that's ever decayed in our universe leaves its shear, right? Whereas the lensing only comes from the mode that's dynamical right now. Right? And so you have every previous scale contributes to this fossil, which is a gigantic advantage. And so all these projection effects and these apparent effects, I think, are all just tiny in comparison to this.
Great, if there are more questions, let's thank you again.